Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind, well, I'm traveling this week, so we'll bring you a special from the archives. The Neapolitan Novels are a series of four books written by Italian author Elena Ferrante. They trace the decades-long friendship between two working-class girls from Naples. The novels became surprise hits in the U.S., and now the first book in the series has been adapted for the small screen, airing on HBO. So this week, we bring you my 2015 reader's review of that book, My Brilliant Friend. My guests were Maureen Corrigan, book critic for NPR's Fresh Air, Lewis Byard, author of several books, including Roosevelt's Beast, and Laura Benedetti, professor of contemporary Italian culture at Georgetown University. Lou, talk about the two main characters in this book.
There are two girls from the mean streets of Naples. Their names are Lila and Elena, and they meet in, I think it's first grade, and they strike up this friendship which will carry them all the way through the torments and terrors of adolescence, and they'll emerge at the other side of that, still friends, but in a very complex and fraught way, and their lives go in directions that neither of them expects. So they wind up having completely different notions of what their lives are going to be and who they are and where the life is going to be taking them.
And at times they separate, then they come back together. Laura Benedetti, how realistically portrayed is life in Naples for these two girls?
I think it's very realistic. You know, Naples is a city that was that went really through tough times during World War II. It was very heavily bombarded. So the Naples, after the war, is a devastated city that is trying to get back to its feet, and that's where the narration begins, and therefore the portrayal, I think, was very, very realistic. It's a tough city to this day, and there is this very pervasive atmosphere in the novel of lawlessness and violence, with some hints at the organized crime, the Camorra, which is the Neapolitan version of the mafia.
Interesting. And to you, Maureen Corrigan, just to help us know who these girls are, could you read for us from page, I think it's 46?
46, certainly, Diane. This is a scene in which Elena, who is the narrator of the novels, and she's narrating the novels as a woman in her 60s. She's remembering back to their childhood in this book. This is a scene in which she realizes that Lila, her friend, who turns out to be the queen bee, has displaced her in the eyes of their teacher. Lila knows how to read, and Elena has up until this day been the favored student. So here's Elena's memory of that day. What that demotion caused inside me, I don't know. I find it difficult to say today, faithfully and clearly, what I felt. Perhaps nothing at first, some jealousy like everyone else. But surely it was then that a worry began to take shape. I thought that although my legs functioned perfectly well, I ran the constant risk of becoming crippled. I woke with that idea in my head, and I got out of bed right away to see if my legs still worked. Maybe that's why I became focused on Lila, who had slender, agile legs and was always moving them, kicking them, even when she was sitting next to the teacher, so that the teacher became irritated and soon sent her back to the desk. Something convinced me then that if I kept up with her at her pace, my mother's limp, which had entered my brain and wouldn't come out, wouldn't stop threatening me. I decided that I had to model myself on that girl, never let her out of my sight, even if she got annoyed and chased me away.
And Lila is very thin.
Yes.
She's wan, and Elena is hale. Yeah. And they're such different girls in so many characteristics.
You know, one of the things Ferrante does so smoothly is to show almost day by day the power relations between the two girls. And especially as they enter adolescence, Leela, who is thin and wiry and is not the bombshell that Elena is. Elena is blonde and plump and, you know, kind of in that 50s Marilyn Monroe model of womanhood. But you begin to see through Elena's eyes that something is happening with her friend Leela that is attracting all the men in the neighborhood, that she's got some kind of power, some charisma that is growing month by month as she's in adolescence. And it reawakens memories in me as, you know, an adolescent girl, where you began to see the hierarchies shift in middle school in terms of who was on top, who was prettier, who was more developed, or else who had that magical something.
And which the two girls begins menstruating and doesn't know what's happening, Laura.
Yes, that's Elena or Lenu, so she's our narrator. And that's the time, so puberty is also the time where Elena becomes even more afraid of becoming like her mother, which is another powerful element in the passage that Maureen just read. There is a kind of almost hatred, actually it is called hatred in the novel, that Elena feels against her mother. And her friend Leela is a way for her to escape that destiny. So that's why she models herself on her brilliant friend.
And why is there such hatred by Elena for her mother?
Well, the mother is a very opaque character. And I think what Ferrante does, she does not overanalyze Elena's feelings towards her mother. So in other words, we often have these remarks about the mother's physical appearance. So the mother has perhaps astigmatism. There is one eye that doesn't work properly. She also has a problem with one of her legs. And Elena really insists on those elements. And I think Ferrante does a beautiful job of not overanalyzing Elena's feeling, of staying at that level, almost visceral, instinctive repulsion. It is called repulsion in the novel towards the mother.
Pretty strong language.
Very strong language. She's a writer who doesn't show much sentimentality towards her characters.
Here's our first email from Tanya in Tacoma Park. As an avid reader since childhood myself, she says, I was struck by the shared love of reading that Leena and Elena bond over. Do your guests think that thread within the story is one of the reasons the series has charmed and hooked so many bookworms? What do you think, Maureen?
Well, certainly speaking as an aging bookworm who can remember that. Yeah, of course, one of the books that the girls bond over is Little Women, a translation of Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. And then, of course, Elena grows up to be a writer. I'm looking ahead to the other books because there are four novels in this series. But there's a quick moment in this first book, My Brilliant Friend, where Elena is out walking with a boyfriend and she realizes there's something missing and they can't talk about books the way she can talk about books with her friend Leela. And, you know, you just know what she's talking about.
Do we know how Elena learns to read? Do we know how Leela learns to read?
Leela seems to be an autodidact.
Yeah. Exactly.
She teaches herself.
She I think it's her brother.
Yeah.
Her brother is learning to read, she kind of
she
gloms
in.
Onto him while he's learning to read and surpasses him very quickly.
And then the whole question of school and after the elementary grades, whether these two girls will be permitted or whether their parents can afford to send them on to the next level, Laura.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There is a point in which Elena kind of discovers that school doesn't stop with middle school, that she may have such a thing as a high school, and it's kind of a discovery for her. So what we have now, it's two very promising, two brilliant friends, really, who have the great potential. But then we see one of them who moves forward and is able to keep on studying, and the other one who withdraws more and more into her social reality, into her neighborhood. And this is a problem of opportunities, but it is also a problem of attitudes. There is a passage I like very much in the novel. The first time they venture out, they have this idea, they want to go and look at the sea for the first time. So already we know that they live in a city like Naples or on the Mediterranean, but they've never seen the ocean. And so they venture out, but at some point, Elena is thrilled. She likes to keep going, while her friend Lila gets scared and she wants to go back. And this different attitude really marks the different development.
And that's surprising, because indeed Lila is the more adventurous. She is the greater risk taker. And I was surprised to see her want to turn around, go home again.
Absolutely. And in fact, even Elena is very surprised. She later on, she says that it took her a while to understand what had happened in that particular instance. If I may read a short passage, she says, right after this adventure, she says, "All night I tried to understand what had really happened. We were supposed to go to the sea, and we hadn't gone, had been punished for nothing. A mysterious inversion of attitudes had occurred. I, despite the rain, would have continued on the road. I felt far from everything and everyone, and distance, I discovered for the first time, extinguished in me every tie and every worry." Lila had abruptly repented of her own plan. She had given up the sea. She had wanted to return to the confines of the neighborhood. I couldn't figure it out.
And do you figure it out?
Well, there is. It's not clear. It's not completely clear, I think, why Lila gives up all her ambitions. In other words, it's not clear whether she hopes that by staying in the neighborhood, she wants to she may have a stronger role, a stronger influence. So it's not completely clear whether the decision to stay in the neighborhood here and later throughout the four novels is based on courage or is, on the contrary, based on fear of the unknown, fear of what may happen outside the neighborhood. Incidentally, I think it's the third novel in the series. It's titled in Italian Storia di chi fugge e di chi resta. In English, has been translated as those who leave and those who stay. Huh. But the original Italian is those who flee. So there is which is not as neutral a word as leaving.
That's
right?
A key distinction. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So there is almost an element that Elena is almost guilty of something for having left the neighborhood.
I feel as though I'm listening to music when I hear you speak. It's just wonderful. And now a quick break. When we return, more of my conversation about Elena Ferrante's My Brilliant Friend.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my 2015 conversation about the novel My Brilliant Friend. The idea of shoes comes into this novel rather strongly.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Lila is the daughter of a shoemaker. She's impoverished. It's hard not to think of Cinderella in this context. The poor girl who finds her prince. He's the local grocer, but he's pretty wealthy by the standards of their neighborhood. She agrees to basically let him take care of her. But the shoes figure in all through the book. The Cerullos, Lila's family, are trying to get out of poverty through the use of these Lila's designs.
It's Lila's design. Mm-hmm. She's trying to move her father into thinking larger.
She is, and when you read about her plans, her ambitions for these handmade, beautiful shoes, you think, oh, if she were only doing this a couple of decades later, she'd have a beautiful boutique on some street in Naples, right? But that's not to be.
But her brother is supportive of her desire to do something.
Her brother is supportive, and she's also trying to take care of her brother. Even though she's younger, she can see that he's going off the rails, and that part of the danger is that he's going to become involved with the organized crime, the gangs that are so powerful in the neighborhood. So she's almost like a mother figure to him in some ways, a stern one.
Lou, talk about Don Achille.
Yes, Don Achille. He's the father of Stefano, the local grocer, and sort of the great man of the neighborhood, you know, at least in this context. He exercises a kind of mythical power over these two little girls when they're young. They think that he's some ogre-ish type who is taking their dolls and committing sort of unspeakable acts. And at one point, this terrifying moment, these two little girls, you know, creep up and try to break into the house. But it's interesting, and again, it's part of Ferrante's subtlety, is that Don Achille really was guilty of crimes. He was a black marketer who exploited his fellow citizens, who takes away the man who eventually kills him, sort of puts him out of business. So he is a kind of ogre in his own way, but not in the way that a childish mind will understand.
But that childish mind, those two young girls, here is Lila, who takes Elena's doll and drops it into an area and then Elena turns around, does the same thing.
Yes.
To Lila's doll. So both dolls are lost.
Absolutely.
What is the symbolism there?
Well, that's the first episode really of that friendship. I mean, that's the way the narration opens. Well, the book begins with Elena trying to recollect the story of this friendship and doing so almost as a revenge. Actually, that's the way the beginning. The beginning of the narration is presented. But then the first episode is precisely the episode of the dolls. So right from the beginning, we have a sign of the strong ambivalence that marks this friendship. Again, Ferrante's lack of sentimentality. They are friends, but they are also rivals, and they don't hesitate to do mean things to one another. And so the two dolls disappear, and when they disappear into this black hole where the two girls have thrown them, and when they cannot find them, they decide that it must have been Don Achille who stole them. Because Don Achille is a black marketer, but in Italian the word is the borsanera, the black bag. So the dolls have ended into Don Achille's mysterious, fantomatic black bag, which must hide everything that disappears in the neighborhood to the eyes of 2 6-year-old girls, because at the beginning they are that young.
At the same time, the handling of that episode, it seems to me, is the perfect setup for the tension and the love within that friendship.
Yes, and as Laura has alluded, I mean, it's a constant game of checkmate between the two of them. And in fact, once you read all 4 books in the series, I'm not spoiling anything, you go back to the first novel and you say, oh, so that was what was going on, as Laura said, this revenge. I'm thinking to a passage later on, again in the series, the last novel, where the adult Lila and Elena are walking through their old neighborhood
together,
and Elena is now somebody in the larger world. She's got a reputation, certainly a literary reputation. And they walk through the old neighborhood, and Elena notices how people are looking still at Leela and says, I'm the one with the reputation, and still she's the powerful one. It just, you keep having those moments where certainly Elena is trying to get ahead of Leela, and she's always checkmate.
How much, Maureen, do you believe that the series portrays friendship between young girls, teenagers, women into their 60s accurately?
Yeah, I think it does a beautiful job of portraying a certain kind of friendship.
What is that certain kind?
Through Elena's eyes, it's a friendship that's very much born out of admiration and fear and need.
Competition.
You know, Leela will always be the person who, in a sense, knows Elena the best. But Elena doesn't know. Does anybody know Leela the best? Leela is a little. She keeps her power by being removed, and I certainly think that that kind of relationship exists out in the real world.
What about the economic conditions of both households, Laura?
They are both very poor households. They both struggle to make ends meet, and they go through similar hardship. Perhaps Elena's is slightly better off. Elena's family is slightly better off than Leela's family, though.
Why?
Because the father works for the government. He's a porter, so it's a low paid employee. But still, that seems to be, from what emerges in the novel, a better job than being a shoemaker.
And now it's your turn. We're going to open the phones, hear your comments about Elena Ferrante's book, My Brilliant Friend. It is part of a series, and this, My Brilliant Friend, is the first. Let's open the phones now. First to Centerville, Virginia. Jenny, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Very interesting discussion.
Good.
I just finished listening to the first two novels in this series on tape, and one is better than the next. But the question I'd like your panel to maybe address a little is, throughout the books, Ferrante alludes to possibly Leela having some, like, mental imbalance. I think in the first book, at least, she describes Leela having sort of fears of her boundaries with people dissolving. And, you know, they both are from the same sort of low-income, tough neighborhoods, and they both are brilliant. But it seems, I always felt a little bit that maybe Leela's mental issues might have impeded her, where for Leenu, that was not, she was just a more stable personality.
What do you think, Laura?
It's hard to tell. What Ferrante does here and in her other novels is to try to find a name to describe some kind of psychological discomfort. But I'm not sure that's strictly pathological. I'm not sure there is a specific a mental illness behind that. I'm giving you another example from her previous novels, from Troubling Love. She talks about fragments, and she describes, she says that her mother used that word, frantumaglia, so going into fragments, to describe some sense of discomfort, and Ferrante describes that as debris on the murky water of the mind. And the mother mother, when the mother does something that she cannot explain, something out of sheer impulse, she attributes that to this kind of malaise, this kind of discomfort. So in My Brilliant Friend, we find this idea of dissolving margins,
yes,
this fear that things cannot be contained, that people may just dissolve. It's a feeling. I'm not sure that there is a precise mental illness behind that.
Lou?
Oh, I think it's also a nice description of the friendship between Lila and Elena. The margins are always dissolving, it seems like, particularly for Elena. She has very little sense of herself as an independent, autonomous being. So much of what she does is driven by what Lila wants or what she thinks Lila wants, or by Lila's achievements. So there's this sense that Elena is always kind of dissolving into this friend of hers.
What do you think about mental illness?
I think it's a possibility. I think it's also true that a source of Leela's power is that you can't predict that she's going to stay in bounds. And I'm thinking of one scene late in this novel where two young men sort of try to grab Elena and pull her into their convertible with them. And there's Lila with this kind of handmade knife in her hand, and she's at the throat of one of these guys in a second, you know, because she's not constrained. And really, in literature, any woman who can't be confined, who changes quickly, is always the powerful woman. I'm thinking even in fairy tales, it's always the enchantress who changes shape or personality, who's got the power. So I guess maybe I'm coming at it from a literary point of view, but it makes sense to me that Lena would be the uncontrollable one, the one you can't quite figure out, the one who changes quickly, and that she would hold most of the cards.
One question I had, and it goes back to going to the sea. Do you believe that Lena knew she was powerful? You do?
Oh, I do. Yes, I'm nodding seriously. I do. And even that passage that Laura read about the girls taking that illicit walk to the sea, and then Lena deciding to turn back, and you think this is so uncharacteristic. She's the daring one. Well, there's another take on that decision to turn back. Elena later that night thinks, well, maybe Lena wanted to get me in trouble by luring me along on this adventure to go to the sea, and in getting me in trouble, make my parents so angry that they wouldn't give their consent to further schooling. In order to be discovered, they had to return at a certain time. And I think that maybe the returning at an earlier time, Lena deciding, let's go back, is tied in with that discovery.
Interesting. There is violence throughout this book. Lou, read for us from, I think it's page 37.
Yes, it starts at 37. And this is Elena addressing the reader directly. She says, I feel no nostalgia for our childhood. It was full of violence. Every sort of thing happened at home and outside every day. But I don't recall having ever thought that the life we had there was particularly bad. Life was like that, that's all. We grew up with the duty to make it difficult for others before they made it difficult for us. Of course, I would have liked the nice manners that the teacher and the priest preached, but I felt that those ways were not suited to our neighborhood, even if you were a girl. The women fought among themselves more than the men. They pulled each other's hair. They hurt each other. To cause pain was a disease. As a child, I imagined tiny, almost invisible animals that arrived in the neighborhood at night. They came from the ponds, from the abandoned train cars beyond the embankment, from the stinking grasses called fetienti, from the frogs, the salamanders, the flies, the rocks, the dust, and entered the water and the food and the air, making our mothers, our grandmothers, as angry as starving dogs. They were more severely infected than the men because while men were always getting furious, they calmed down in the end. Women, who appeared to be silent, acquiescent, when they were angry, flew into a rage that had no end. I love that passage, and I also love the metaphor of Vesuvius, which is always sort of off in the distance, right? They see it off the horizon, this idea of volcanic rage always ready to erupt, and periodically does in fairly shocking ways. At one point, Lila is thrown out a window by her father, mm-hmm. thrown out a window. She breaks her arm in the process. We talked about the Solaro boys. At one point, one of them reaches into the trunk of his car and brings out this basically iron bar that's been sharpened to a point to engage in a standard street fight. Violence is always present, and fathers are beating their children, their wives. It's always there.
Lou, how were you affected personally?
I love the novel, and I found it at one level kind of inspirational. Somebody wrote recently about how Ferranti is writing the American novel. She's writing about the American dream, just transposing it to Naples. Mm-hmm. We see upward mobility of a kind that used to be possible in American society and is less so now. We see these two girls from very hardscrabble origins, and they achieve upward mobility, in Lena's case, through her mind, through education.
Marie. I love the novels, and to tag on to Lou's point, I think especially my brilliant friend and the novels that follow also show us the cost of that upward mobility, what you pay, especially in Elena's case, for leaving the neighborhood.
Well, I'm going to tell you how I felt. I saw a great deal of myself in this book, in both Elena and Lila. And therefore, it's been a very powerful read for me. Thank you all
so much
for being here. And that's all for today. We'll be back with new shows next week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Yurev-Livker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.